Thank you, Ms. Ao, for that wonderful introduction, and to you for the very kind welcome. And Ms. Johnson, who, as you know, runs this organization and also went to the best college in America. I wouldn't tell you which one. And you will discover why I'm giving her those accolades later. No, we went to the same college, and that's why I'm here. It is a privilege to be here today among so many educators. I'm one of those, and I'm sure like most of you here, who owe a lot to teachers. Yours is a noble profession, and it is important that society and individuals recognize what you do. And lessons teachers leave with us stay with us all our lives. I can remember lessons I picked up from my teachers in high school, which are still with me. I recall one day one of the teachers came to the classroom and put a board, sort of a white sheet on the wall with a black dot in the right-hand corner. He then pulled back and asked us, and there were 45 of us, we had big classes even then, and said, "Boys, what do you see?" It was an all-boys boarding school. That's why there were no girls. "Boys, what do you see?" And in unison, we all said, "A black dot." He shook his head and said, "Not a single one of you saw the broad white sheet on the wall. You all saw the black dot. Don't go through life focusing on the negative. There's lots of goodness in the world too. In our world today, that black dot will perhaps also stand for our country, and the larger world around that country will be the white." And this is what you are trying to bridge with your work. Over the past 6 decades, NAFSA has led debate and informed public policies in the crucial areas of international education. Through your work and advocacy, you have provided opportunities for young Americans to study abroad and opened up this country's educational system for students from around the world. And the benefits have been enormous to the individuals concerned, their countries, and the wider world. My time at McAllister also taught me something. I was fortunate to be, so I can speak to your program from a personal experience. My time at McAllister as a Ford Foundation program called the Foreign Student Leadership Project was among the most rewarding and formative of my life. It helped open my eyes and taught me lessons which have remained indispensable throughout my career. Not all these lessons were learned, I must admit, in the classroom or in academic formal programs. I remember when I got to Minnesota, my first winter ever, coming straight from Africa to Minnesota, and I had to put on layers and layers of clothing to stay warm, and I thought that was reasonable enough. But there was one item I was determined I will never wear, because I saw people wearing the earmuffs. I said, "I'm not going to wear the earmuffs. They were inelegant, and you know, until one day when the temperature had hit -33 degrees with a wind chill factor, I went to get something to eat and I thought my ears were going to fall off. The next day, I can assure you, I went and bought my earmuffs. And I wasn't concerned about whether it was big, it was elegant or not. And I learned a precious lesson that you don't walk into a situation You don't go into a country and pretend you know better than the locals. You know better than the natives. You better listen to them and look at what they do. Yeah. Yeah. The result of the exchange of ideas and experiences provided by international education, of course, is far more important than saving a vain young man who foolishly puts style before common sense. By improving and understanding and fostering dialogue, you are preparing young people for leadership that they will need to assume and on which our future depends. For never before has it been so essential to give young people the knowledge, the skills, and the wider horizon they need to become active and engaged global citizens. Nor has education itself ever been more important. For the strength of countries and their potential rest on human capital. Those societies which invest in education, research, and innovation will thrive, and those which fail to do so will continue to struggle. This is why the crisis in both access and quality of education in the developing world is such a serious concern. Despite welcome improvements in access to education in recent years, more than 60 million children still don't attend primary school. Another 70 million do not enter secondary education. Perhaps as worrying is the quality of education for those who do attend school. More than 200 million children in the developed world receive education of such poor quality that they leave without the most basic literacy and numeracy skills. These children should be our next generation of leaders, doctors, scientists, and teachers. But we are squandering their potential and denying them their basic human rights. Across the world, an estimated 776 million adults, or 16% of the world's adult population, lack basic literacy skills. The situation is particularly serious for women, with 1 in 5 unable to read. Although the gender parity in primary enrollment is now within reach, girls are still less likely to go on to secondary education. In some places, they face extra set of family and cultural barriers compared to their male brothers, such as unpaid work or as caregivers at the home, forced marriages, early motherhood, and sometimes the threat of violence and harassment. We have to set up and really step up our efforts to support girls and women and remove barriers to gender equality in education. No society can fulfill its potential without respecting the rights of women and nurturing their talents. Thank you. Yeah. But education is not only a concern for developing nations. In this prosperous country where we are today, 1 in 7 adults has such low literacy skills that they struggle to read above a children's picture book. With declining opportunities for unskilled jobs, they face permanent unemployment or wages at poverty level. There are also major employment worries in many developed and developing countries for those with knowledge and qualifications. Unemployment rates among young people are rising everywhere. Economic growth in many countries remains weak, and the growth we witness is not creating the decent jobs we need. We are in danger of allowing an entire generation to be cut off from opportunity and prosperity. This requires radical rethink of our economies and our employment policies. We also need to look afresh at whether what is being taught in our schools and colleges equips young people with the skills they need in the outer world. But ladies and gentlemen, these skills have to go beyond the academic and practical in order to help them succeed and lead in today's interconnected world. What is important is that wherever we live, our fate and fortunes are more closely linked today than ever before. Decisions taken in one country can have impact on communities many miles away. I think the last economic crisis, the past few years, has taught us that. The housing bubble that burst was the U.S. bubble, but it had impact all around the world, and we are still living with the consequences. Climate change, for example, is not a future abstract threat, but one that has already made an impact, making conflict, famine, and disease and poverty much worse. Across the globe, temperatures are rising and extreme weather events, as we have seen here in the United States and elsewhere, are becoming much more frequent and the costs are huge. No matter how powerful or wealthy, can cope with these challenges alone. We cannot resolve today's great social, economic, and political and environmental challenges without collective action based on shared values and ideals. We may need to act locally, but we must always think globally. This country has long been known as open and welcoming to immigrants, thus creating a diversity that has given its economic and social progress a real impetus. Yet, in recent debates about immigration, we have seen this diversity portrayed as a weakness, a negative view which NAFSA has worked hard to counter, and I applaud you for that. As your annual report has shown, international students contribute approximately $20 billion to the U.S. economy each year. Any glance at some of your most successful citizens shows the contributions of those who decide to make their lives here. These contributions are much, much greater than we often or normally realize. My dear friends, so how do we maximize the benefits of pluralism across the world while tackling fears and concerns of some? The answer lies, as always, in promoting dialogue, understanding, mutual respect and tolerance amongst people, something I know from the UN can be hard and often slow, but can be done. And this is where the program you support and the work you do here in the United States and across the world is so invaluable. You are on the front lines of these efforts to increase understanding and build new ethos of global citizenship. For no one is born a good citizen or a democrat. This understanding needs to be taught, nurtured, developed, and encouraged. You have understood that the best way of doing this is through teaching and providing opportunities to young people to learn about different cultures and different conditions of life. From my own life-enhancing experiences over 50 years ago in the United States, I can assure you, my friends, that you are on the right track. Student-teacher exchanges build understanding, widen horizons, and replace fears about what divides us with recognition of what we share. And this is an approach that I'm encouraging even today in my capacity as Chancellor of the University of Ghana. Those who return home after graduation often become leaders in their countries and encourage global thinking when responding to local situations. Those who stay are contributing the skills and knowledge they have gained, fueling innovation and helping to stimulate the economy of their host country. A good education is, however, more than just an entry point into the job market. It is about the formation of character and not merely transmission of knowledge. Life is about choices, and education needs to equip young people with the right values and skills to choose the best path. We need you to encourage our academic institutions to continue to provide the time, space, and conditions where young people can learn the broader skills needed to become future global citizens. The right incentives must be put in place to encourage greater civic engagement and active participation in finding solutions to local and international challenges. Academic institutions must review education curricula and learning materials so that they can reflect the global community that we live in today. Topics such as Global Development Framework, including the Millennium Development Goals, the rule of law and human rights, could be integrated into school curriculum and core subjects. The model United Nations, where young participants role play as diplomats representing a country or an NGO in a simulated session, have been fantastic success and should be scaled up. They teach students the importance of international institutions and valuable skills such as how to debate, negotiate, advocate, compromise, and speak publicly without getting angry. We also have to provide more opportunities for students to contribute to real-life projects and provide internships and vocational training in sectors that are in high demand. This includes the chance to learn about climate change adaptation and mitigation, renewable energy, food and nutrition security, and entrepreneurship. While many emerging countries are putting huge efforts into teaching their young people new languages, many developed countries and their students seem to be taking the opposite approach, and I would encourage them to try to learn other languages and other cultures. It broadens you in a manner that one would not imagine. Information and communications technology also provide new opportunities to move beyond traditional models of education and expand access to knowledge, skills, and networks. We need to harness the power of technology to help us exchange positive ideas and build mutual understanding. Ladies and gentlemen, let me end on a positive note. Looking around our countries and traveling the world, it is clear that the challenges are great. It is easy to become depressed about the state of the world. But the more I see and hear of the younger generation, the more confident I become. They are perhaps the first generation of truly global citizens who seem to understand almost instinctively the responsibility this places on them. We desperately need their fresh perspective, their energy and commitment. We also need to hear their views. This is the aim of my series of online conversation with young people on issues central to their lives, which I launched earlier this month. They are called the Kofi Annan Dialogues Live, and I'll be delighted if you were to become involved. As you know, we cannot expect young people to rise to the challenge in front of them on their own. They need our active support and the opportunities to learn and to grow. We need to help them along that route. The generational change is going to come anyway, whether we resist it, whether we want it or not, and it will be best for us to work with them and to prepare for them to take over. But I have also told the young people, one is never too young to lead, so they should not hold themselves back when they have the talent. And this is why your work is of such critical importance. You are helping provide the best possible foundation for a new generation of leaders we so desperately need. There is no nobler cause, and I wish you all the best in your endeavors. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And now I invite John Sawyer to facilitate the discussion with Mr. Annan.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here with you, Mr. Annan, and also with NAFSA, and to be in St. Louis, where I began my career many years ago. I want to commend NAFSA and Marlene for having the good sense to schedule this conference in the same week that the St. Louis Cardinals are playing. Just a few blocks down the street, and I hope that you, Mr. Annan, and others here will take advantage of the opportunity to walk a few blocks and experience one of the world's great sports teams. It's so fitting that you'd be here this month and with NAFSA, and the same month that the Kofi Annan Dialogues Live are beginning, and the work that you are doing with the One Youth World leading up to the Johannesburg Conference, and your commitment to education, as you just talked about in your eloquent speech. The NAFSA itself, this I know very much shares that focus on education, and certainly the Pulitzer Center, where I spend my time working with journalism education, this is issue, an area that we are very committed to. And so it's appropriate to begin with that. We've had questions submitted from people participating at NAFSA, and as you can imagine, they cover a range of issues and topics as broad as those that you've been engaged in your own long career. But I think it's good to begin with education, since that is the focus that we all share. There's a question from Rebecca Ziegler-Mano with Education USA in Zimbabwe. And she says an admissions officer from McAllister College first saw the potential of a young man from rural Ghana. Today, financial aid and scholarships for economically disadvantaged African and other international students are increasingly scarce. How can international educators help make the case for the importance of providing the scholarship help?
I think by doing what you're doing, this conference, for example, is extremely important, and I hope you would also be able to engage your congressmen and parliamentarians. It's important for them to understand that it's a win-win situation, and that you need to sort of expose the young people. When you look at the figures, I mean, there are figures which indicate about 100,000 Chinese would be studying in this country, and about 11,000 American students studying in China or abroad. And if we're going to live in an interdependent world, we need to expose our young people to the world that they are going to inherit. And by traveling, by getting to learn about other cultures, meeting other foreign students or studying with them here or abroad, they come back with much wider horizon, and it's in everyone's interest. And I really hope that the politicians and parliamentarians would understand this. Often we are prepared to put money in defense, but this is a very sound investment, investing in the young people and the future. And so my own approach would be to encourage governments, to encourage university, encourage philanthropists to make contribution. And I, as I said, I'm an example. If I hadn't had the Ford Foundation grant and gone to McAllister, I don't know what would have happened. I probably would have had something to do. But my wife always asks, how do they know? Because the name of the program was Foreign Student Leadership Project. So they were scouting around for... So she said, how did they know? I said, how would I know? But I hope other young people will get the same opportunity.
Why is it that it seems it was an easier sell politically to make the case in those days? Was it just because we were in the Cold War and it was seen as a competition with the Soviet Union, or were there other factors involved?
No, there were other factors. First of all, African countries and many Asian countries were becoming independent. So there was a sense that we should try and help these countries and bring some of the potential leaders to the West to be educated, for them to be able to make a contribution. The Cold War helped also, there was a sort of a competition, and you had lots of African students also going to study in the Soviet Union and in the East. But I think there was also a certain optimism and a sense of solidarity. And it was also during that period that President Kennedy and others sent out young people not only to study but to work in other countries and gain experience and come back. But as difficult as the climate is, when there are economic difficulties and money is tight, we tend to be less generous. We feel less prosperous and we become less generous. But I hope when the tide turns, your programs will be supported actively as they did in the past.
There's a related question from Bob Erickson, who's a retired professor at UCLA. And he says, NAFSA members believe in the value of this work, but too often it appears that the people in our home universities and communities are not listening. What lessons from your own life and professional experience can help us to be more effective in promoting the importance and impact of our work?
I think you should also try and bring in the community. Bring in the community by exposing them and bringing them and the foreign students together. It's quite amazing sometimes what both sides learn. And if they know that these people in the community have something to offer and have things to teach them. I mean, I can recall from my own student days, we were very much welcomed by the community. Families invited us. We went out and did things, went to homes, and sometimes spoke to church groups and all other student groups, sharing experiences from our own culture. And there were moments when you learn a lot in unintended events. You know, I recall once I had been invited to dinner, and the family had a young son, Jimmy, who was playing with the food. And the mother said, Jimmy, stop wasting food. Think of all the starving little Africans. And then immediately turned and said, Kofi, you must have this, you must have that. We have a lot, you know. And I said, God, she's so generous, she's going to feed me for the next month, you know. But we talked and we laughed about it. But earlier it had been, think of all the starving little Chinese. And then you see where they are today. And, you know, and when you encounter these sort of situations, you talk about it, they ask, how are things in your country? And you explain and you learn from each other. So exposing the students and bringing the society in, I think, is an important way.
There are a number of questions that seek your perspective on troubling current events. And maybe first up again with one from Marie-Odile Savaril, who is with the American Business School in Paris, asking if you see a resolution to the Syrian conflict, the conflict in Syria, anytime soon. And of course, as everyone here, I'm sure, is familiar, you were the special envoy until last year.
Yeah. No, the Syrian crisis is a really tragic issue. The nightmare the Syrians are living in cannot be, it's unimaginable. When I got engaged early last year, the death toll was about 20,000. Today it's 80,000, and I consider that low. You also have about 8,000 Syrians leaving a day. You have 1.5 million Syrian refugees outside their country. You have about 4.5 who are internally displaced in their country. And you have millions who live the daily humiliation of survival, looking for things. If you are sick, hospitals are bombed. What happens? Where do you go? And yet, the international community and the Security Council have not been able to come together to work in unity and maintain sustained pressure on the parties to stop the killing. You know, you can look at the Syrian crisis in a sort of three circles, the inner circle being the national situation, where the crisis started as a grassroots demonstration for democracy and freedom of expression. And the government cracked down very hard. Today is a civil war with the government and its supporters on one side and the opposition, which is also made up of the Free Syrian Army and lots of militia, and coordination amongst them very difficult. So you have that division internally within the country. And within the region, you have the divisions too. You have countries like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, firmly supporting the opposition. You have Iran, Iraq, and others supporting the Syrian regime. And it's been very difficult. When I was envoy, I organized a meeting in Geneva, which is called Geneva One, where I brought the foreign ministers of the permanent members of the Security Council to a meeting. We had Hillary Clinton, Lavrov, and all of them were there. The two secretaries general of the Arab League and the United Nations, and foreign ministers of Qatar, Kuwait, and Iraq. I had tried to bring the two other key countries, Turkey was also there, but I tried to bring Iran and Saudi Arabia to the table because they are also very important, but it wasn't possible. And that was where we decided that you needed a political settlement, and I thought they were going to work very hard on that. That was a year ago, to be a year next month. They went to New York and started disagreeing again. And so the divisions have persisted. The international community the Security Council, which is the outer circle, and could have come together to push the region, and then the country is also divided and in a way has also exacerbated the problem. I'm encouraged by the suggestion that a meeting will be held in Geneva next month where the U.S. and the Russian Federation will work together with others to try and find a peaceful settlement. It is not going to be easy. It is going to be very tough. It's to begin with to be tough putting together the Syrian delegations. And my own sense is that things are going to get much, much worse because you either have a particularly if you don't have a political settlement. Political settlement means you're offering an alternative, a framework. If you don't get that and try to encourage and work with the Syrian parties on a political settlement which protects the interests of all groups in Syria, and you allow the military logic to dictate the outcome, the group that wins, I'm sure, will engage in revenge killings. It will demonize the other and ethnically cleanse the other. So the situation could get much worse. And this is why I'm really hoping that the efforts that are being made now, as late as it is, will yield some results. But the situation in Syria is really terrible, and we should cry for the Syrian people.
At this stage, does a political settlement entail a division of the country? Is there any possibility in your mind of a settlement that keeps Syria whole?
It's not going to be easy. As you've noticed, the conflict is spreading beyond Syria to the neighboring countries. And this has become sectarian war within Syria, which will inflame the region. And Lebanon, which compared to Syria was relatively easy, took 15 years. And that should give us an idea of how complicated this situation is going to be and the time it is going to take to put it together. Whether Syria is held together or whether it goes a Lebanese situation where various groups control certain parts of the country and they learn to live together or they will come up with another formula, I think will depend on the negotiations and the discussions. And the approach of the international community has been the process must be Syrian-owned, Syrian-led, and they should do what their future needs and deserves. So it's difficult to say what their final outcome would be, but we should do everything to stop the killing. Let's start with whatever we can to stop the killing.
In your book, Interventions, A Life in War and Peace, you wrote with candor and regret about the international community's failure to intervene sooner in Rwanda, Bosnia, and Darfur, and your pride in the later enactment of the Doctrine on Responsibility to Protect. In places like Syria, Eastern Congo, and elsewhere, are we seeing failure, that kind of failure again? And why hasn't Responsibility to Protect worked better as a doctrine so far?
I think for those of you who are not familiar with the emerging norm of responsibility to protect, it is a norm which the United Nations at the summit level endorsed that a government has a responsibility to protect its citizens from crimes against humanity, gross and systematic abuse of human rights. And if the government either fails, is unable or unwilling to protect them, the international community has a responsibility to go in and protect. This is a relatively new norm and is going to take time to take hold. And let me also say that when the norm was put forward, which I pushed very hard, the intention was not always to use force. In fact, I think the most successful application of the responsibility to protect is what happened in Kenya in 2008, where a conflict broke out after the elections. The government declared they had won. The president was sworn in at midnight. The opposition said the elections had been stolen, and it led to a real war. 1,300 people were killed, and 650,000 people were uprooted from their homes. I and two others, former president Nkapa of Tanzania and Graca Machel, the wife of Nelson Mandela, were given a mandate by the African Union to try and calm the situation. We went in January 2008 with the support of the entire international community, the European Union, the US, everyone worked together with me to resolve this conflict and to put concerted pressure on the Kenyans. In the end, they agreed to power sharing arrangements and a massive reform program, including a new constitution, which has made quite a lot of difference. 5 years on, they held elections, it was contested, it went to the court ruled, everybody accepted, there was no violence. And the difference between that and Syria is that the international community that was united in the case of Kenya is hopelessly divided in the case of Syria. And I should also hasten to add that you cannot intervene in every situation. And in some cases, the intervention may make it worse, particularly if you go in with force. But the fact that you cannot intervene everywhere does not mean you should not intervene where you can. I personally believe that military intervention in Syria will make the situation much worse.
Is it realistic to think that the United Nations, as an international institution, can make a decision absent the kind of agreement that you had in Kenya by the major players internationally? Because part of the argument on responsibility to protect was that somehow we would have a structure that would decide this.
We should have a structure that decides it, but that structure is the member states. That structure is the Security Council. You know, when we talk of UN, we have to be careful how we describe. I usually try to say we have two UNs. The UN that is made up of member states who sit in the Security Council and give us the mandates. And then the UN that is the secretariat that implements the mandates. On the question of Syria, to begin with, the Council has not been able to see eye to eye and come up with an approach or a mandate that would work. And even if they did, let's assume they were to decide theoretically to intervene militarily. Where are the troops going to come from? UN doesn't have troops. It has to come from countries like the US, France, India, and others. Are they prepared to put their troops in the situation in Syria? And if they are not, I think we need to look for other options, other solutions, and be coldly realistic and not create the impression that there's a caravan on the horizon, help is coming, when, honestly speaking, I'm not sure many of the countries that are engaged are ready to put their troops on the ground, and which also argues for putting all their weight behind the political settlement.
There's a question from Shamil Erdogan of Istanbul Bilgi University that touches on a far different issue in the heart of Europe. And what he describes is the paradox between the increasing emphasis and funding for human rights education and the use of all of the marvelous technology tools that we have today to show the interconnectedness of the world and the human rights curricula that have been introduced and teaching of toleration and tolerance and so on. And yet, even in places like France and Germany and the United Kingdom, and in recent months, we've seen repeated incidents of violence and discrimination against suspect so-called targeted groups. And the question that I think that Shamil was asking is, does this indicate in some way a failure of the educational model that all of us are trying to push of engagement in these issues? Why are you not seeing it get more traction?
Yeah. I think it is important to teach students about human rights, about the rule of law, to teach them that what binds us is much more important than what divides us. But we also have to be realistic and accept that in times of economic difficulties, there is a tendency to scapegoat, to identify the immigrants, the outsiders, as the ones who are causing all our problems. It is an irony that globalization has brought us so closely together. We are living together in our cities, and yet the tensions go up. And this also indicates the amount of work and education that must go on, that we need to keep at it gradually. And you know, there were quite a lot of countries in Europe which were calm, homogeneous, and would have told you we never have discrimination problems. Of course, you never have discrimination problems until you have somebody to discriminate against. Once they come in, this is a problem. And as the world becomes smaller and people are moving, I mean, I saw what happened in Sweden, which is a shock for them, in the sense that it's been a very peaceful, calm, welcoming country. And they've received lots of refugees and political exiles. And in fact, today, I think the largest Syrian population in Europe is in Sweden, because they've allowed them to. I've seen on television people asking my Swedish friend, what happened? What went wrong? How can this happen here? But it's a feeling of being outside, not being integrated, and not belonging. What I think we need to accept is that migration will continue. Migration cannot be stopped. What we need to do is to manage migration for the benefit of the migrant, for the country of origin, and for the recipient country. That is the only way to do. Some people think you can close the doors, you can build all the walls, you cannot stop migration.
We did a project with the Pulitzer Center in Bangladesh a couple of years ago on water and sanitation issues, and I was there for a couple of weeks, and then we went to the World Water Conference in Stockholm, so we were in Sweden. And when we got to Sweden, the papers were full of stories about Bengali migrant workers, vegetable pickers in the north of Sweden, and the horrific conditions without sanitation and water in Sweden. And this is a situation that I didn't expect, the kind of thing that we're beginning to encounter. We had several questions about Africa, including one from Savannah Kadima of NAFSA, asking about the recent report of the African Progress Panel, which you share. And that report found that between 2008 and 2010, Africa received on average about $30 billion a year in aid from OECD DAC members, but lost over twice that amount to trade mispricing and other illicit outflows. It's a question about corruption and how, she asked, does Africa change that status quo?
I think some of the correction can be handled by African leaders, but the African leaders cannot do it alone. What is important is for us to recognize that Africa is sitting on enormous resources in gold, diamonds, cobalt, oil, gas, properly managed, and the resources invested in society, in education and health, infrastructure and energy. Africa can take off. But sometimes you have a combination of corrupt leaders and companies that come in and get involved in shady deals with tax evasion or avoidance, with transfer pricing that allows them to take our profits. And of course, the Africans sometimes don't always have the skills to monitor these things and know that they are losing that much money. And this is why we are challenging in that report, asking the G8 and the G20 and these powerful countries also to become concerned about transparency and accountability. They are concerned about it because now they realize that they have also been losing lots of taxes. And they are keen to have accountability and transparency. And I think we need a multilateral system that will help them and help the Africans even more. Because it is true that Africa loses about twice as much of the money that it gets in development assistance. And so we intend to pursue this with the powerful countries to see how we can work together and also maintain the pressure on the companies. And with transparency, you can do a lot because the Dodd-Frank Act is asking companies to declare how much they pay. Any amount above $100,000 should be released. The European Union is going to do the same thing. We want the African governments also to say how much they have received and how they are using that money. And I think transparency would help someone like the person asking the questions and lots of Africans.
We just did a project on a Dutch NGO supporting building a conflict-free mine in Eastern Congo, tin mine, and to comply with the Dodd-Frank rules. And it's a very small pilot operation, but it is an indication of the possibilities, the potential here.
I agree with you. I agree with you that we can really make a difference if we can get everyone to cooperate. Not everyone, but let's say if we get majority of the corporations to cooperate and the corrupt officials are also held to account.
There's a very interesting article in the current Foreign Affairs by Morton Jervin, the author of Poor Numbers, how we are misled by African development statistics and what to do about it. And he makes a point about the World Bank figures on Ghana, your home country, that I think 2 years ago that was recategorized as a low middle-income country instead of a low-income country after the economic discovery that the economic statistics had failed to account for the massive adaptation, adoption of mobile phones, a surge in spending on private education, a burgeoning small-scale service sector, and all of which indicating that maybe we've been missing an African success story. So what do you think about that?
There's real problem.
And not just in Ghana.
There's real problem with the data on Africa. And in fact, now we have a situation where quite a few institutions are trying to focus on correcting this one. The main one is the Economic Commission, the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, which is based in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa. The executive director is reorienting his program to focus on ensuring that the Africa, we have the right data for analysis and for projection on Africa, because the data is very weak, unreliable, and this is what led to the correction in Ghana, and I'm sure we'll see it in other countries. So we need to go back to the basics and ensure we have the right data.
We had a challenging question from Chika Maruta and David Lorno of the Sake Institute of Study Abroad, asking, what is the biggest failure in your career? And I might add, what did it teach you?
I think perhaps one of the most difficult and painful one was all the efforts we put in trying to avoid the Iraq war. I almost took it as a body blow because we all worked very hard. The Security Council did not pass the bill, the resolution. And in fact, if the resolution had gone to a vote, I don't think U.S. would have got more than 4 out of the 15 votes. And so they went without it. And some people say the U.N. Failed. And I keep telling them, no, the U.N. acted the way it should have by not endorsing a war that they didn't believe in, a war that they thought was wrong. And if there was a problem, the problem was those who ignored the U.N. and went to war. But it brought such division within the... It brought such division within the membership, which I was sure it was going to come about. And it's an extremely difficult situation for a global organization when you are torn apart. Europe was torn apart. The world was torn. Remember, we had New Europe and Old Europe, and the world and other parts of the world were torn apart. U.S. tried very hard. It couldn't even get the votes of Mexico and Chile in the council. But it places the Secretary General in an extremely difficult situation. You have to hold on to the principles, but also have a responsibility to work to bring the parties together, to bring the to heal the divisions, so that the organization can carry on with this work. And you can imagine, having gone through a war, which was won very easily by the U.S., which and the Bush administration feeling rather victorious and vindicated, and the other side feeling humiliated and ignored, and trying to bring everybody to work together again was a tough period.
But you did, through the United Nations. I covered that debate at the United Nations at the time, and my sense was that that was the one place where we did have a real debate and challenge of the policy. It was unsuccessful in terms of blocking the war or coming to a consensus. Yeah. But looking back, if you look back and you see now what record was established, I would not put that in your list of failures.
No, it was interesting in the sense that we worked so hard. I put so much of myself. I was on the phone with the leaders around the world, with people saying, you know, we can't, including talking to President Bush. So when it actually happened, it was quite, and having been involved with Iraq for so long, and knowing what the consequences were likely to be, and not working with a whole group of other leaders, but having no impact. It was. But you're right that the real debate took place in the UN. On that issue, I wish there had been much more debate in the US, in the public and around the world. Other countries did, but not in the US.
Well, we're out of time, but thank you for informing our debate and all the work that you do.